It's important that there are communities like yourselves who are so supportive of Israel, and it's something that we never take for granted and appreciate enormously. Now, I don't want to give you a lecture this evening. I want to make this as interactive as possible. If you disagree with anything I say, please say so. I won't take offence. In fact, I welcome it. There's a famous old Talmudic saying that if two people agree with each other, they learn nothing. If they disagree, they both learn something. So please bear that in mind and don't be afraid to take issue with anything that I say. I've got a few slides which I'll go through reasonably quickly, and then we'll open up the floor for discussion. I just want to make a couple of preliminary remarks, first of all. Those of you of a certain age will be aware that time seems to speed up as you get older. I see a lot of heads nodding. I'm roughly the same age as the State of Israel, a little bit younger, but we're of a similar age. I certainly feel that time is speeding up, but I know that that's a very subjective perception. When it comes to Israel, I actually don't believe that's a perception. I think that's a reality. I think events are coming upon us with ever greater rapidity. And I want to put to you a hypothesis as to why this might be happening. I think there are two fundamental reasons. One is internal to the State of Israel, and the other is external. Now, internally, Israel is developing at an absolutely breathtaking pace. I mean, just think about it. It originally started out with a population of 650,000. Today, it's approaching 9 million. When I lived in Israel as a child, there were about 1 million people, all told, in the population. When I returned in the 1960s after the Six-Day War, there were about 3 million. And then when I made Aliyah and I went to live in Israel in the 1980s, there were about 5 million. And today, as I say, there are nearly 9 million. Now, it's taken the planet Earth 500 years to increase its population tenfold, and it's taken Israel about 50 years to do the same thing. Something extraordinary is happening there. It's not just that the population is increasing, and that in itself brings its own problems, as you can imagine. There's a lot of poverty in Israel. Just in passing, I should emphasize that the two groups who are causing most concern to successive Israeli governments in terms of poverty are perhaps two groups that might not immediately come to mind. They're Haredi or ultra-Orthodox men and Arab women. Those two groups primarily are suffering the greatest burden of poverty in the country, and that's why those groups are being targeted by special government programs today. But the point is, Israel is an enormous success story. It used to be a developing country not all that long ago. Today it's a member of the OECD. It has one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's known as the startup nation. Its innovation is legendary in all kinds of fields, in science and technology, in healthcare, in agriculture, in conservation. And that really brings me to the second reason why I think something interesting is happening here. Along with that tremendous vitality that we see being projected by Israel to the outside world, that in turn is generating a reaction, Newton's second law of thermodynamics. And that reaction from many quarters is extremely hostile. In fact, the one generates the other. In other words, the more successful Israel is perceived to be, the more her enemies become enraged and even panic-stricken. And they take up the hostility on an exponential basis. Now, up until now, all of these efforts to neutralize the effects of Israel's development have failed, fortunately. And various strategies have been employed, whether it's war or terrorism or boycott or lawfare. They've all failed, but they haven't given up, and they won't give up. If we think about what has been happening in Gaza, and I'll certainly talk about that shortly, since 2008, there have been three wars with Hamas in Gaza. That's not a coincidence, because Hamas is being funded and trained by Iran, which declares quite openly that its main foreign policy objective is the obliteration of the State of Israel. This is quite unprecedented in world history. And yet, despite that, there are many people around the world who seem blind to the threats that are being issued. So I believe that those two sets of drivers, internal and external, are interacting with each other in a dynamic way and in a very dangerous way. And we have to be aware of that, and we have to really be prepared for another very difficult year next year. What's happened in the past is we can't change it. We can try and understand it, but we can prepare for the future, including the immediate future, which I suspect is going to be a difficult one for us. Just before I move on to the next slide, just for those of you who may be curious, epidemiology is the study of epidemics, not the study of the epidermis, as young medical students tend to believe. And epidemics, well, there is an epidemic in the Middle East just now, an epidemic of violence. By no means the greatest amount of violence has been focused on the Arab-Israeli conflict, although there has been much there, but nevertheless, I think it's quite legitimate for those of us in epidemiology and public health to try and seek to prevent that violence. If that's not a public health issue, I don't know what is. Let me just pick up this device. Just before I continue, in the interest of full disclosure, I have dual UK and Israeli citizenship. I was born in Scotland, but I've lived in Israel for about 9 years all told. I've worked there, I've served in the army, and I've kept close links with the country over the years that I've been living in this country. I'm non-partisan politically. I have my own political views, but when I speak on this subject, I'm not aligned with any particular political party or any particular government. I've always striven to adopt an evidence-based approach. As I said at the beginning, if there's anything, if you think I'm factually wrong about anything, it's really important that you tell me, because I don't want to continue to be promoting falsehoods. I just want to acknowledge these two organisations, particularly North London Friends of Israel, who very kindly have advertised this event and stand with us, an organisation that I've been associated with for a couple of years now, and who have their own website. If you don't know it, please have a look, and you'll see that there are many resources available to you there. Okay, let's just think about some of the issues that have hit the headlines in 2018, and I'll go through some of these fairly quickly, and then we'll come back and discuss them in a bit more depth. First of all, the opening of the US embassy in Jerusalem, often described as Trump's embassy move. Well, in fact, it was no such thing. Donald Trump, all Donald Trump did was fulfill his election promise. Four previous American presidential candidates made the same promise, including Barack Obama, including Bill Clinton, and they simply didn't do it. Now, you can argue that there were good reasons for not doing it. I suspect the State Department, which is rather like our Foreign Office here, put pressure on the White House not to make that move, even though Congress had mandated it around 20 years earlier. But Trump was actually the first president to fulfill his election promise. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, at least give him credit for that. He promised he would do it, and he did it, and his predecessors did not. I mentioned at the top there that the first country to recognise Jerusalem as Israel's capital was actually Russia, the Russian Federation. Again, not widely reported. It was announced in April 2017 by the Russian Foreign Ministry, and it took Israel by surprise to such an extent that they rather downplayed it. They were frankly disarmed by it. And the reason for that was that in the course of recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, or rather West Jerusalem as Israel's capital, they also recognized East Jerusalem as Palestine's capital. So you can see from an Israeli point of view, they were somewhat conflicted, because Palestine, as we know, doesn't exist. And Israel has declared that it is sovereign over a united Jerusalem. So it presented a problem for them. They rather played it down. And in any case, the global media totally ignored the fact that it had even happened. But I think it's something to be aware of, that Trump was not the first person to make that gesture. Now, it's important to bear in mind a couple of things. First of all, the American embassy has not moved into East Jerusalem. It is simply in West Jerusalem, which under any conceivable peace treaty with the Palestinians would remain part of Israel. It's worth contrasting that with the European Union, that made a tremendous fuss about this, protested in the strongest terms, and condemned it. But the European Union has got representation, has got diplomatic representation to Palestine in East Jerusalem. There are around five European diplomatic missions in East Jerusalem. What are they doing there? If the objection to the American announcement is that it preempts a negotiated outcome between Israel and the Palestinians, then placing diplomatic missions in East Jerusalem is doing the same thing. So the hypocrisy is very clear. It doesn't have any impact on the two-state solution. I've called it 2S, 2P here. That's two states for two peoples. Very important, that second half of the formula. It's not just about two states. It's two states for two peoples. We keep being told that the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership have recognized the need for two states, but what we don't hear is they've recognized the need for two Palestinian states, because they want a new Palestinian state in the West Bank, and they want a second Palestinian state in Israel as a result of the influx of the descendants of the 1948 refugees, which will immediately create an Arab majority in present-day Israel. So let's move on. Gaza. This is actually the most painful part of 2018. This whole episode, if that's the right word, started in March. It didn't happen. It didn't coincide with the opening of the American embassy on the 14th of May, which happened to be Nakba Day, so-called, the date that the Palestinians commemorate what they claim is their mass expulsion of Palestinians from present-day Israel. But you could argue that the timing of that move was somewhat unfortunate, to say the least. The riots began back in March, and Hamas made no bones about what they were attempting to do. They called it the March of Return. They were calling on their supporters to breach the border, to break into Israel, and not to wave flags or hand out sweeties, but to find Israelis and to capture, to kidnap soldiers and to kill as many people as possible. The Hamas leadership announced on through their Facebook pages and through social media, they said, if you're hungry, eat their livers. Tear their hearts out of their bodies. Now, that's pretty shocking, but what is even more shocking is the mainstream media outlets like the BBC and CNN simply refused to report these remarks. and were determined to portray what happened as a peaceful demonstration, either against the opening of the US embassy, which was an odd way of looking at it, considering the riots started before the embassy opened, or as an expression of frustration at the lack of a Palestinian state or of a peace process. And that's simply not the case. That is not what happened. It's a distortion of reality. And again, it fits in with this narrative that somehow or other, whatever happens, the Palestinians must always be portrayed as victims and the Israelis must always be portrayed as aggressors. The worst day of violence was 14th of May, as I mentioned, Nakba Day. And it was a gift to the media because, what you probably remember, they used this split-screen technique where they showed you on the one hand the rioting on the Gaza border, on the other hand the ceremony whereby the US embassy was being opened. And that forged a link in people's minds. It was, from a media point of view, it was great. It was a great story. But it was a travesty of the truth. It had nothing to do with the realities on the ground. And so the narrative took hold of disproportionate Israeli force, of Israeli massacres of unarmed protesters. And we know that that wasn't true, and there's good epidemiological evidence why that wasn't true. What do I mean by epidemiological evidence? And it's there at the bottom of the slide. If what had happened had been an upsurge of popular anger or frustration, and tens of thousands of Gazans had approached the border to express their anger and despair and frustration, and the Israeli army, as the media reported, had simply opened fire on unarmed civilians, one wonders what would have been the proportion of casualties amongst those people who were killed or injured that were affiliated with Hamas or other terrorist organizations. Well, we know that about 1% to 2% of the Gaza population are Hamas members. What we discovered from the meticulous recording and examination of each and every casualty that the Israeli army undertakes is that 85% of the casualties were Hamas operatives. That could not have happened by chance. That is just wildly improbable. Any biostatistician will tell you that. That's epidemiological evidence that the narrative of indiscriminate violence against a peaceful civilian population just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. That doesn't mean that the violence could not, under any circumstances, have been avoided. It is possible that had technologies been available or had been deployed, that it would have reduced those casualty rates, something a better outcome might have been achieved. But the fact of the matter is, according to the Israeli army spokesman, such technology does not exist. The IDF have very clear rules of engagement, which involves a graded response. First of all, warnings. Second of all, the use of tear gas. Thirdly, firing in the air, and only as an absolute resort, the use of live ammunition to people who are seen to pose a direct threat to either the soldiers or the civilians. So there's the IDF code of ethics, the so-called purity of arms, and I can confirm with you that that is still in force to this day. The IDF takes extremely seriously the need to protect civilians. And those Israeli soldiers that were allowed to speak after their experiences on the Gaza border made it very clear that that code of ethics was implemented and adhered to, and where there were deviations, investigations have been launched. Not everybody in the media adopted the same line that this was an Israeli massacre of innocent Palestinians. Here's a tweet from a Telegraph journalist that some of you may have seen. And there have been other similar reports, but again, it doesn't fit the narrative that Matti Friedman has so well articulated, the idea that the narrative that the global media have adopted in relation to Israel is that anything that happens has to be portrayed as an illustration of Jewish moral failure. Now, I'm not suggesting that the journalists and the editors have a conscious view of the conflict where they're constantly trying to seek to portray Israel in that light. But I do believe at an unconscious level, they have internalized that view, and that affects their editorial decisions. But we may come back to that. Okay, let's move on. As I say, I'm going to go through this list quite quickly, and then we'll come back to discuss these issues in more detail. The defunding of UNRWA. Yet again, a lot of negative publicity surrounding this. My own medical colleagues wrote a letter signed by hundreds, literally hundreds, of British and mainly European doctors. They wrote a letter to The Lancet, which I think some of you may have heard me speak about The Lancet in the past and its attitude to Israel. And essentially what they were doing was saying that this was an outrageous decision by the United States. It was going to cause severe hardship to the Palestinian population, and it was simply playing into some kind of Israeli-generated agenda for continuing to deny the Palestinian people their human rights. And in fact, this issue of UNRWA is one that, in a sense, goes right to the heart of the conflict. Because what we saw since 1948 was a focus on the Palestinian refugees, whatever number one takes as the official number, let's say, roughly speaking, 500,000, who today, their descendants have reached around 5 million. This agency, UNRWA, was set up as a temporary solution. It was not intended to be there decades later. And there's the main term of reference of UNRWA that I've put on the slide. I won't read it out to you. Interestingly enough, the original United Nations resolution, which called for a resolution of the refugee problem, did not specify Palestinian refugees. And in the early years, Israel assumed that it applied to all refugees of the conflict, which within a matter of a few years had resulted in a massive Jewish refugee problem as well. There were some Jewish refugees from the 47 to 49 conflict, but later on there were another 850,000 Jewish refugees from the Arab world and from Iran. Incidentally, yesterday, November the 30th, is the day that Israel commemorates that expulsion of Jews from the Middle East. They chose the 30th of November not because it was St. Andrew's Day, although it did occur to me maybe that was in their minds, but it's not that. It's because it's the day after the UN partition resolution of November 1947. So that resolution was passed on the 29th of November. 30th of November, the war started that produced these disastrous effects for both Palestinians and Jews and Israelis. Incidentally, the staff of UNRWA today, I've said they are about 30,000. That's roughly the number of original refugees that are left. The surviving refugees from 1948 number roughly 30,000. So in a very short period of time, there will be more staff employed by UNRWA than there are actual refugees. It will be a ratio of more than 1-to-1. And that has to be put in the context of no UN agencies for any of the 850,000 Jewish refugees. No budgets. The costs, it's about $1.3 billion per year. And it's estimated that roughly $50 billion have been allocated to UNRWA. and the Palestinian refugees since 1949, and that is compared with a figure, a very easy figure to remember for the Jewish refugees, which is zero. So when the United States administration announced that it was going to cut back, initially what they said was they were going to reduce by 50% the budget for UNRWA in the hope of inducing Mahmoud Abbas to the negotiating table. When that didn't work, they said, okay, we're going to go the whole way. Incidentally, all of that shortfall of funding has been largely compensated for by, guess who? The European Union, who believes so strongly that this decision was misguided that they are prepared to continue to fund UNRWA with all the negative consequences associated with that. Important to realize what UNRWA is up to here. UNRWA nurtures the fantasy, and it is a fantasy, of the mass return of the Palestinians, not just the refugees, but their descendants forevermore into today's Israel. And that is a fantasy. And the international community knows it's a fantasy. But they still collude with that delusional idea. And not only that, while that fantasy is being nurtured, the conflict can never end because refugee status is perpetuated from generation to generation. So how long is this going to go on for? We've already reached 5 million so-called refugees. Are we going to wait till they reach 15 million or 50 million? It's an absurdity. And it really is important that at last somebody, it happened to be the Trump administration, but this should have been done many, many decades ago. And UNRWA should be challenged. If you look at the UNRWA emblems, you'll see there the maps of Palestine with no mention of Israel. They are not preparing the Palestinian people for peace with Israel. They are continuing to promote violence. In fact, the teachers themselves are often members of Hamas who incite violence and perpetrate and disseminate openly anti-Semitic notions throughout the whole of the Middle East and throughout their organization. So, yeah, we can discuss that later if you would like to. Okay, let's talk about the nation-state law briefly. Again, a lot of negative publicity surrounding this. Not just from the usual suspects, but from people who normally are well-informed and moderate in their attitudes to Israel. Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian, a newspaper that's not noted for its sympathy towards Israel, but nevertheless, Jonathan Friedland is a well-informed journalist. What he said when he wrote about this was that Israel is effectively, through the nation-state law, relegating Israeli Arabs to second-class citizens. With not a shred of evidence, because it's not true. So just to remind ourselves what this nation-state law is, it's one of the basic laws, of which there are about a dozen. Israel has no constitution, but it has passed over the years a number of basic laws. It's been in the pipeline for several years. It has cross-party support. It's not an initiative of the right wing of Israeli politics. In fact, it originated from a centrist party in 2011. And the reason why the current government decided to push it through, and you can argue about the timing, and you can accuse Netanyahu of electioneering, because we know an election is coming up next year. But the fact is that we have to look at the context within which the law was passed. The law itself doesn't change anything. It simply asserts that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. It is a Jewish state. And that is in the context of the Arab Higher Monitoring Committee, which is an Israeli Arab organization, suggesting that the notion of Jewish statehood was racist and illegitimate. And it also has to be seen in the context of foreign attempts to delegitimize Israel through the BDS movement, boycotts, divestments, sanctions. As I said, it has no legal effect, it has no practical effect on civil rights. It simply states what the UN partition resolution stated in 1947, no less than 27 times, that Israel is a Jewish state. But we've reached the point now in 2018 that to call Israel a Jewish state is per se regarded as an affront and unacceptable, even to intelligent, well-informed journalists like Jonathan Friedland. There was a flurry of opposition, mainly from the hard left within Israel, and interestingly enough, from the Druze community, not so much from the Arab community, who you could argue have come to terms with the notion that they are living in a Jewish state as a minority with full civil rights, even though they don't have national rights within Israel. The Druze community took strong exception to this. And an emergency meeting was held by the Israeli Prime Minister with Druze leaders to reassure them that their status has not changed. The Druze are held in very high esteem within Israel for all kinds of reasons. But going back many decades, the Druze population have they initially volunteered to serve in the Israeli army, but they insisted that young Druze men should be compulsorily conscripted along with Israeli Jews. And for that reason and others, there's a strong bond between the Druze population and the general Israeli Jewish populace, and that this was considered a very serious development within Israel, that the Druze leadership was opposed to the nation-state law. Their ruffled feathers appear to have been smoothed over, but it may well be that some form of amendment will be passed that will take account specifically of Druze concerns. What these precise concerns are is not clear to me, but I have heard it said that one of the reasons they were so unhappy about this was that a sector of the Druze leadership are aspiring at some stage or another to seek some form of national autonomy within the Golan region, which is where the majority of the Druze population live. But whether that's true or not, I can't confirm. Okay, we can't really finish this survey of 2018 without addressing the issue of anti-Semitism. This is not new, of course, particularly within the Labour Party. You'll remember the Livingston formulation. For those of you who don't, it means accusing the Jewish community of playing the anti-Semitism card to silence criticism of Israel. And in fact, that's a CNN journalist has recently been sacked for calling for the destruction of Israel, and he has tweeted or used social media to defend himself by arguing it seems that now any criticism of Israel is regarded as anti-Semitic. When in fact, of course, that's complete nonsense. If any criticism of Israel was anti-Semitic, all Israelis would be anti-Semites. And most Jews in the world would be anti-Semites. It's an absurdity. And nobody is suggesting that criticism of Israel equates to anti-Semitism. But there are very clear guidelines on this as to where the line is crossed between criticism and anti-Semitism, and that's been developed by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and we may go into that as well later on. I think the last time I showed this slide in this hall, the young man with the whitish beard in the middle hadn't yet risen to the political prominence that he has today. That's him. I think it was around 2011, 2012, but I showed the slide around 2014, thereabouts.
Do you think he stands a chance to become the next Prime Minister?
Oh, I think it's a near certainty.
What?
I think it's a near certainty. But I don't want to get diverted. Let's come back to that. A lot of the problems within the Labour Party arise from their view of the conflict. And for many people on the left of the Labour Party, they just don't get it. They don't understand this notion that it can be anti-Semitic to deny the right of the Jewish people to self-determination. They don't get it when they call for Israel's destruction and then they are accused of being racist, because they don't call for any other country's destruction. So we need to help them understand that, but I wouldn't hold your breath about how successful we're likely to be. Very important to recognise there is anti-Semitism on both the far right as well as the far left, and they only agree on one thing, and that is who the real enemy is. But unfortunately, we're not dealing with a phenomenon just of the extremes. Anti-Semitism has entered the mainstream in quite a big way. And we know that from survey after survey, this particular one was from 2017, that about 30% of the British population harbour prejudice towards Jews. This was a well-conducted survey, incidentally. And that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. That has been confirmed by a more recent CNN survey, actually is just more or less hot off the press, of 7,000 adults in European countries that are listed there, including Britain. And again, we're dealing with figures between a fifth and a third of the population hold prejudicial views, and you'll see some of the views that are expressed there. And the questions were framed around these anti-Semitic tropes. I don't know how well you can see the section on the right, but certainly, again, about a third, a little bit more than that, link some of these prejudicial attitudes to Israel, claiming that Israel uses the Holocaust for its own nefarious purposes, and that anti-Semitism is used to shut down criticism, the Livingston formula. So this, from being a phenomenon of the extreme left or the extreme right, we're finding in survey after survey that large swathes of the population actually believe this stuff. And that's extremely disturbing. Linked to that is the notion of BDS. And you probably heard about the row over Airbnb delisting some of its properties in the West Bank. Only properties, incidentally, being let out by Jews in the West Bank, not by Arabs. So that was discriminatory. And they're perfectly happy to continue to list properties in the Western Sahara, occupied by Morocco, in Northern Cyprus, occupied by Turkey, and in all of the other conflict zones around the world where there are disputed territories, not least in areas like Tibet and Kashmir, where there is a much stronger ethical case for delisting, but it seems that Airbnb, for whatever reason, have decided to focus on this particular part of the world. Now, as we speak, there is legal action proceeding against Airbnb, and my prediction is they'll have to back down because they won't have a leg to stand on legally. But it's a reflection, it's a symptom of a general malaise whereby, although BDS is widely said to be ineffectual economically, and it is, it's not making a huge impact on Israel's economy, that is not its prime purpose. That is not its prime purpose. The purpose of BDS is to delegitimize Israel. It's through a kind of drip of hostile propaganda, essentially, people will increasingly feel uncomfortable about going there, and corporate entities will gradually withdraw. We know about the Quakers as well. You'll have read about the Quakers. This is particularly painful for Israelis and for Jews, because the Quakers were always seen to be good friends of the Jewish people, and during the Second World War, they really behaved heroically in saving many thousands of Jews from the Nazis. But in recent years, that has all changed. They have now decided, they flipped over, they have now decided the Palestinians are the new Jews and the Israelis are the new Nazis. And they use extreme language of this kind. I've had personal experience of that with Quaker colleagues in my own university. Talking of academia, I put up this headline about a conference in South Africa. There's no formal boycott of Israeli academics in South Africa, but what is happening, it's been made clear to Israelis that they are not welcome to attend conferences in South Africa. And there's a kind of silent boycott going on. It's not official. And in many countries around the world, an atmosphere is created which is driven by BDS activists to ensure that the message gets through, Israelis are not welcome. And either conferences are cancelled or applications are rejected, or in my field, papers are refused publication by major journals when they see the origin, not the quality of the paper. Israel has the highest number of scientific and medical publications per capita of anywhere on the planet. But there are certain medical journals will not publish papers when they see that the origin is an Israeli academic institution. Now, I see that as a result of personal knowledge. I'm not at liberty to present you with the evidence for that, but it's been well documented. Okay, all of that's been a bit grim, a bit gloomy, but there's a lot of good news out there. And there's just a few of the headlines that might have cheered us up a little bit. Tourism is now approaching 4 million visitors a year to Israel, and there's absolutely no sign of that tapering off. The headline in Al Jazeera is about the visit to Israel of the president of Chad, a Muslim-majority country. And something that people haven't really given Netanyahu enough credit for is his Africa policy. In fact, his Middle Eastern and Africa policy. He has done more in this term of office than all of his predecessors put together to open up connections with the African world and with the Muslim world, with the possible exception of Golda Meir in the 1950s when she was foreign minister, and when, before the Six-Day War, Israel was forging good links throughout Africa and Asia, virtually all disrupted by the secondary Arab boycott following the Six-Day War and particularly following the 1973 war. So there's a lot happening in terms of covert and overt diplomatic connections between Israel and countries that previously would have had absolutely no connection with her. Annette, you'll remember from the Eurovision Song Contest, and incidentally, that will be a battleground for 2019. So I'm just going to finish now and open it up for discussion by giving you some a flavour. You'll have been able to come up with a list of your own very similar to this, I'm sure. Donald Trump's deal of the century. What on earth is the American administration going to do about this? It was supposed to have been announced a year ago. Then it was going to be announced this year, this autumn. It's been put on hold for a variety of reasons, the main one being that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, has said he doesn't care what's in the deal of the century. He rejects it outright. He's already rejected it, even though he hasn't read a single word of it. Has that led to outrage in the United Nations or in the Western media? Not a word. In fact, most people would be unaware of that Palestinian position. It will be interesting to see what happens. Most Israelis and Palestinians are extremely pessimistic about the prospects of a peace deal in 2019, because after all, there have been at least 12 opportunities that I've counted in recent decades to establish peace, and they've all been rejected by the Palestinian leadership. I should emphasize, by the leadership, not by the Palestinian people. The Israeli Attorney General is grappling at the moment with no less than 4 cases of potential corruption that may be, charges that may be levelled at the Prime Minister. And you may wonder, why does it take so long for these charges to come to fruition? We've been hearing about this for years. Well, it's interesting, in the Israeli legal system, there is a protracted period of investigation until charges are laid. Once somebody is indicted, 90% of those cases end up with convictions. It's not like this country where charges are laid relatively early in the process and lots of people are discharged. In the Israeli system, if you are indicted, there's a very high probability that you will be sentenced. You will be convicted and sentenced. So this is all coming to a head, and it will happen very soon. And if that is the case, then Netanyahu may well be indicted, or at least people very close to him will be, and it's hard to imagine how he will survive that process. Nevertheless, he is known as the great survivor, and he will doubtless pull a rabbit out of the hat. And one of those rabbits may well be something in relation to the diplomatic process with the Palestinians. We don't know what that might be. So that will be interesting to see. There has to be a general election in Israel by the 5th of November next year, in any case. The Israeli media are predicting that it will happen a lot earlier than that, but who knows? Let's wait and see. It seems likely there will be a confrontation with Hezbollah in 2019. There are already more than 100,000 Hezbollah rockets pointing at Israel from southern Lebanon. Last night, there were some Israeli raids on Hezbollah positions, not in Lebanon, but in Syria. And it seems that there's likely to be more activity on that front. But that is going to be an existential risk to Israel. And senior Israeli army strategists have already been preparing the public for the fact that the next war, which is likely to be from the north, on the northern front, is going to affect the whole country. It's not going to be like the Gaza wars, whereby the vast majority of people affected were in the south. But this time, what the Israeli chief of staff has said is that in the next war, the residents of Tel Aviv will not be sitting in cafes. So that's a serious concern, and I think that it's a grim situation, unfortunately, which again, the European Union, the United Nations, are either oblivious to or are disinterested in. And I've mentioned the Eurovision Song Contest, so there's going to be a lot of BDS activity around that, demonstrations, attempts to pressurize artists into pulling out of that contest, and sadly, I think they may be successful in some cases. Okay, that's really all I want to say from my end of things. I would like to hear some reactions from yourselves about this, and maybe what we should do is go back to one of the lists, if I can find it, there, and really open it up to any comments or questions from the floor. Thank you very much.